The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1279.DE2230, certificate number 26624, Tartans.
I just saw some pictures of you in your Seafarer Commodore outfit. What's the thing? King Neptune.
King Neptune.
Not just a Commodore.
There are Commodores all around me trying to bring me drinks.
Do you feel like Neptune outranks the Commodores?
For sure. I mean, the Commodores are part of the seafarer tradition. A lot of them have been Commodores for decades.
I was just trying to pick a nautical sounding word. I forgot there were actual Commodores.
Yeah.
But was Lionel Richie there?
The King? No. Unfortunately, that would be... Or I mean, he might have been in the audience, but I was looking out at the crowd during the parade. I didn't pick him out.
He wasn't there.
No. But the parade, you know, the people that come out to watch that parade are an incredible cross-section of the region. Like, from inside the parade looking out, it's just mind-blowing. All the different kinds of people that come to watch a parade.
Like,
folding chairs, coolers.
And it's like old-timey fishing Seattle, but also, like, blue-haired baristas. It's everything?
The whole thing. And people love a parade. And I've now been in, a half a dozen or more parades in Seattle. Some of them, the real big ones. And
none of them invited.
And every time I'm in hot shorts and have roller skates on, and I'm like, woo! And it's just a great experience. Parades, I think, are wonderful.
You enjoy regalia.
I do. I my King Neptune outfit, I found the basics of it in the archive underneath the Seafair headquarters, and most of it dated to the 50s, back when people still put a lot of pomp into civic traditions, and there were all these jackets that had been made locally that were really not, 50s tailoring.
I didn't know they had an archive.
Well, no one did until...
I just think of them as a hydroplane race, but it has an attached academic arm.
When I went to the office, I was, meeting the CEO, and they were showing me around, and I was like, listen, this is all great, and I love looking at these old photographs, but I know somewhere in this place you have a bin of stuff, and I want you to find it. And they were like, I guess, and they sent some intern off, and he brought out a somewhere... these bins I opened up, and it was exactly what I was looking for. Epaulets and sashes.
See, that's what I don't like about regalia.
Really?
Yeah, it seems like a lot of trouble.
It's so much trouble. So then I, empowered by these...
Like, I don't even want to do French cuffs, no. Much less figure out where the sword goes or the braid goes.
It was so great. I looked at so many different historical pictures of, like, well, now, how did the czar wear this braid relative to how it was being worn by the Duke of Kent?
Is this why it's called regalia? Because you're just going to regale me with it?
I am going to talk about it so much.
Whether I want to or not.
And, you know, and all of the big... And I think I've told you, maybe I've told the audience, that that at one point Adam Savage had tried to do a perfect reproduction of, I think, Wellington's uniform. For some reason, Adam Savage being, you know, just as sure. much of a dork, but he has money.
He would say a polymath, but sure, a dork.
Sure, polymath. Well, so let's call him a polydork. No, it was Admiral Nelson. He was okay. constructing Admiral Nelson's outfit for something.
Probably, maybe he was going to revive him, like Frankenstein style. And he didn't want a nude Admiral Nelson clone hanging about.
It's alive!
He found some hairs with a little follicle, and he's going to Jurassic Park Lord Nelson.
Well, he found these wonderful 19th century Royal Navy epaulets that came in their own case, and they're made out of all this gold wire. I mean, they're beautiful things. And he bought them, and I think they were not cheap to buy. But then found later even better epaulets that came from the 18th century. And so he bought those, and he had these extra epaulets, and he was like, do you want these epaulets for your King Neptune outfit?
You have surplus Mythbusters epaulets.
Like, do I ever? So he sent me the epaulets that really replaced whatever the already gaudy epaulets were.
Like, the ones that were there were probably from some weird lodge in 1920, yeah. And now you've got the real thing.
But when I put that costume on, I do very much like, okay, the sash goes here, the belt goes over that. This gets buttoned to that, but that has to be over the top of this.
Speaking of the Masons.
Metals. And it's a lot to get into it. But then once you're in it, I mean, you have to be, talk about dork. You have to be a real dork.
But do you feel the mantle of whatever authority comes with the regalia?
Well, I do, because people, a lot of those things are recognizable symbols of power that everybody kind of subliminally has, you know, recognizes, like, that's what a big wheel looks like. But those green sunglasses are what a CIA agent looks like. This is what a...
But it's not inherent. You didn't feel it when you put it on. You felt it when others treated you like somebody with epaulets.
I mean, it's one of the reasons I love the city of Vienna, because Vienna masquerades as a modern city, but
it's Lipizzan or Stallion based.
It really is. When you look right up above the billboards,
80% of the economy, Lipizzan or Stallion.
Like, there are all those eye level billboards that are like, try this hand lotion or whatever. But then you look up and you realize, oh no, this whole city was made for parades and made for really intimidating Teutonic, like colonial Habsburg.
Still looks
parades.
Like it. Just blocks and blocks of this stuff.
It does.
It's a parade ground with some cake shops attached.
And the number of hats with giant feathers in it that went through all those cities. And so, it's bullying, but in a way that if I could dress like that every day, I think I would. But I would need to have office, right? You need to hold office to dress like
Stolen
that.
Valor.
You can't just be a door, just like Adam Savage.
You don't want to LARP.
No, it's not LARPing. I was the real king.
But not anymore. When you wear it now, do you feel like you're LARPing?
Mm-mm. Because the reason I was in the parade this year is they had all of the royalty get together. And so there were all these 70-year-old women in tiara with their own sashes. Everybody looked amazing.
Seems like a real potential powder keg to put all these King Neptunes together with their big Neptunian egos.
The thing is that not that many Neptunes showed up. It was all seafarer princesses.
And say.
Then at some point in the 90s, maybe predictably, they said, we're no longer going to call the person who should be the queen, the princess. So we're now instituting a new office, Queen Alcyon, that is, you know, at the same level as King Neptune.
But they're perpetuating the undersea patriarchy by saying there has to be a King Neptune, too.
Well,
Queen Alcyon should be able to run the parade by herself.
Sure, it could be Queen Alcyon and her Prince Neptune.
Sisters are doing it for themselves.
That's not how we do it. And the thing is, there are still seafarer princesses. It's just more of a pageant type of situation. And the princess does twice the work anybody else does.
I bet they reveal them all, and then the seventh one is Ariel, and she's not there.
Right.
They're like, where's Ariel? And then they cancel the parade because only Aquana and a lot of the lame ones are there.
She's living under the sea because she has one fin slightly smaller than the other, and they put her in a aquarium.
I asked you about regalia, not in hopes of getting 20 minutes of seafarer material, although I knew it was going to happen, but because my follow-up question was going to be, have you ever worn a kilt?
Yes. And here's why.
Comfort.
That, but also dating back to the 19th.
Century,
when my father's grandfather arrived here from Wales, the sordid history of anti-Welsh racism in the great state of Ohio
still a stain on their on their flag to this day. The blood of the Welsh cry up from the soil.
They do, and you know they were coal miners, and so my grandfather, when he went to college. That being the first generation of that family to go to college.
Or indeed read a book.
Right. Exactly. And one of the reasons neither you nor I can trace our Welsh history back beyond 1700 is no Welsh person ever learned to read or even knew that reading was a thing.
Yeah. They didn't know the word history. It was very hard for them to keep it.
But he went to a Presbyterian college in Ohio called Worcester College. Mm-hmm. And it had made such an impact on him that he changed the family story.
Right.
Because he was an inveterate liar. And he said, oh, the Rodericks are Scots. And my father and his siblings were raised to believe that they were Scottish.
They all believed it. They weren't told this was a cover story.
No, they were descendants of Scottish kings.
There was probably a ruined castle somewhere that they were going to come into at some point.
And my grandfather was one of these people that could always quote the Shakespeare line that applied to any given situation. Mm-hmm. You know, the generation that knew the Shakespeare and the Bible. And he had this sort of literary affect that acquitted with his story that we were descendants of the Scots. And it wasn't until my dad and his siblings went to Scotland in the 1980s. That the Scottish people they met disabused them of the notion that they were Scottish. But up until that point, when I was a kid, my dad would buy me tartan outfits, including the whole kit and caboodle. The kilt, the belt, the little...
Sporran?
The little pouch with the tassel thing. The hat with the ribbons. Like I had the whole...
The bagpipes.
All of it. And he would buy me tin soldiers. Name another kid my age that had tin soldiers.
I don't think I can name a kid 30 years older than you who had tin soldiers.
And they were tin soldiers of like the, you know, the Black Watch and all these bagpipers, the whole bit. So it wasn't until I was a teenager that suddenly it all came crashing down around me. I thought,
hold on. Deflating bagpipe sound.
And none of us even knew whales from a hole in the ground. And we suddenly had to.
It's hard. That's a tough comparison. that's a tricky one.
Flip it around. And then realizing that we were not descendants of Scottish royalty, but literally people who were in a hole in the ground.
Have you not worn a kilt since?
Latricent. In the early 90s, I was at a party. And a girl who was wearing a black cotton skirt with an elastic waistband and some series of events.
I don't want to know.
Took off the skirt and I ended up with the skirt.
That doesn't count.
And I wore it for a year and a half, every chance I got, because I realized putting it on that we had been lied to. all of our lives. Why are we not wearing
these? The pants are wrong.
These are incredible. The air circulation, the fun, the sort of flounce of them. And so I wore this thing all the time.
But it sounds like not for functional reasons, for fashion reasons.
No, for 100% function. I mean, you know, I was a rugger at that point, and I actually played rugby in this thing. I think at least at my college, famously, I was playing a very aggressive game of frisbee and jumped up to catch a frisbee, and somebody hit me from underneath, and I flipped and landed flat on my back. And some guy standing on the sidelines turned to somebody else and audibly said, "Man, that chick can take a hit," because I had really long hair. And so then that became my catchphrase for a while. That chick can take a hit.
I just got back from Scotland for the first time.
Yeah.
You'd never been
to Scotland in all the times you visited the UK?
Usually in London and, you know, occasional side trips to, I don't know, the Lake District or the West Country or whatever.
Sure. Dismiss the Lake District and the West Country.
No, they're great. But I'm just saying we never were really like, we're going to see the British Isles. We're going to Cornwall. Oh. We never really did the thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to do in London.
And so this time, for the first time, the plan was not to go to London. We were only there for a couple days. It was supposed to be hiking through the Highlands of Scotland and then hitting the Fringe Festival, the Edinburgh Summer Arts Festival, for a couple days.
Have you never seen Trainspotting?
I had seen Trainspotting. Everybody there on our trip, to a man, we're from a parallel Mandela Effect universe where Trainspotting is set in Glasgow. And in fact, Trainspotting is set in Edinburgh, the book and the movie, and shot in Glasgow. But we were just convinced that it was a Glaswegian band. And so, like, you know, the one scene in Trainspotting that's actually shot in Edinburgh is that first kind of heist thing up on Princes Street, which is where you get out of the train station. So I was like, oh, wow, this is Edinburgh. But we ended up not doing the Highlands hike. Somebody had Googled midges, and it turns out August is not the time you want to be in the Highlands.
That's important to know. Midges are no good.
I feel like I'm midge-proof, but we had a very I have a theory.
What makes you midge-proof?
When I get bit by a bug, it just like goes away in a minute. I have some kind of...
That's nice.
It is. And I thought it was only as an adult I learned that I was like, not everybody is in the X-Men.
But wait, you're so pink and
appealing to bugs.
Well, but it just seems like your skin is so close to the blood.
They leave me alone for whatever reason. They want a bigger challenge.
Fantastic. That's nice.
So even as a kid, my siblings would get bit more than me. And
so you were like, come on, let's go to the
But my friend plan exactly. But my friend planning, because you don't want to go to Edinburgh and then not go to the Highlands.
Yeah. Right.
But my friend planning the trip is very bug prone, and he got midge spooked, which is fine.
Midge spooked.
We ended up in Yorkshire instead, and it was a beautiful walk. The Cleveland Way, I recommend.
Mm.
And so we walked for a week in Yorkshire, but we never saw the Highlands. But Edinburgh, what a city.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Who knew?
I mean, it's like...
I think everybody knew. It's kind of famous. But I did not know.
It's dark and weird in the winter, but everything in Scotland is dark and weird in the winter.
That's what you want.
But then, you know, it's lovely.
The way that the crags of Arthur's Sea... There's this big... Like, no other city that I can think of besides Honolulu has this big kind of looming natural landform like that just right above the city.
Did you go up there?
We did. Yeah. We walked up there on our first morning there.
Yeah, it's cool.
And the rain broke, and we had an amazing... Because, you know, Edinburgh is far enough... It's not really a port. You don't get the sense you're on the Firth until you get
until
up
you
high.
Get up and then
and
see
you
out.
Can see the North Sea and the Firth.
You know
and
what
the bridge.
Is what is a weird town is Aberdeen. If you go up there, talk about dark and spooky. Boy... The buildings are all the same color as the sky.
It looks like maybe Aberdeen, Washington was inspired by...
Yeah, so like at night you walk around and you're just like, I don't know what's going to swoop down on me. Some band of people with their faces painted blue are just going to come out and, I don't know, put me in a box.
But Edinburgh also has, you know, it's not like that because it has the old town with the big castle up on the Royal Mile.
Yeah, right.
So it's like, It's got the crazy land. It's like CG. It's not a real city. You've got this Prague-like castle right next to this weird looming crag just right next to town.
It does seem like there are a lot of cliffs.
More cliffs than most cities.
Yeah.
And we found that walking to our hotel from the train station with roller bags. Wow, there's a lot more cliffs and just steep, steep staircases here than most downtowns.
I think I'm actually thinking back to the last time I was there, and I walked past a kilt store, like a Scottish regalia store.
We walked by one called, oh no, I can't do it. It was called like Thistle Do You or something, like it was a pun, a thistle pun.
Oh, like a thistle pun.
Thistle help you? That can't be right.
Like a pho restaurant in Seattle.
Exactly.
But I looked and considered like maybe I should just go in there and just get the adult size version, the whole thing. And then it doesn't take long to realize that that is an investment of a couple thousand pounds or more. Like there's a lot that goes with it, and true tartans aren't cheap at all.
Thistle do nicely. Yeah, so there's a thing apparently, like I was talking to some friends on this trip about the way that Americans will always just belly up in an Irish pub and be like, you know, I have family from Ireland, and you know what? They don't care. They've heard it all. Yes, yes, yes. But
maybe in Dublin. I bet you other places in Ireland, people are a little simpler.
I think they roll their eyes a bit because, you know, do ye now? Yes, every American who comes here has someone from the old sod. But the equivalent of that in Scotland, I guess, is Americans being like very seriously wanting to tell about their clan tartans.
Oh.
You know, and the Scots kind of laugh because they know better. But like tartans are a big modern signifier of Scottish culture, right?
But do the people of Scotland still identify with their clan and wear different tartans? And it's,
there is a Scottish tartan authority that has about 8,000 different. A tartan is a specific fabric pattern that's specific to your, usually a Czech.
And they're all plaids, specific to, right?
We would say plaid. Yeah. Interestingly, the word tartan is, I think, an old French word that just means any kind of coarse fabric. The actual old Scots Gaelic word for that Czech would have been plaid. Like that's their word, but for whatever reason, tartan got only the Scots who came over here and wound up in Appalachia or whatever still say plaid, and that's why it became our pattern. They now say tartan, the much less Scottish word.
This is one of these Norman conquest things where the royals all spoke French.
Yeah, this is a Norman story. This is a story that has a lot of that Norman conquest revisionism, but it's going to go right up through like Victorian revisionism because. You know, today, I had never questioned the idea that these tartans were specific to these historic clans and tribes. And in fact, I don't watch the TV show Outlander, but when we were there, I went to one of the castles where they shoot Outlander. And I guess Outlander gets nasty letters when they put a character named Frasier in a tartan that does not match what the modern day Frasiers think. Because a lot of people named Frasier in America have Frasier tartan kilts and gear in their closet.
Right.
Because they're proud Scots Americans embracing their Frasier history. And now,
as a rock eating Welshman, do you have also Scott in your background?
I looked today. I went on a genealogical website trying to find any evidence of Scott's background. And in fact, I can find Ireland and Wales and some England, but the problem is a lot of my lines start on this side of the Atlantic now. So I think I could 23andMe my way to some Scottish heritage.
Maybe.
But, you know, the people who came over where we actually know their records, they were the big timers. You know, they were landowners or they were Mayflower pilgrims or whatever.
But all the 23andMe-ing that my family has done shows
you more Welsh.
No Scotland, but Irish and Welsh. So that whole idea that the Irish and the Scots have all this Belfast back and forth.
I feel like there are Jennings's north of the borders, which means there should be a tartan. I guess here are people purporting to sell me a Jennings clan.
Oh, sure, they'll
scarf,
do that all day.
Jennings being an anglicization of Mac Shennin, I'm sure. I need to look up the Scottish Tartan Authority and have them make a ruling.
Well, now, I know that you and I, on the fashion tip, you know, you're a little bit more...
Like less well-dressed?
Maybe so. But more and more all the time. Now that you have a team of people in Los Angeles dressing you, you're looking, I don't know, and I'm not sure better is the word, but, you know, at least more, more thought out. But when you look at a list of 6,000 tartans, and by that, by a list, I mean a mosaic mm-hmm. of them, do you prefer some plaids to others?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I think I have ties. You know, my Jeopardy neckties have some checks now, and I have definite preferences. Because there's a wide range of colors in the Scottish tartans as they have come down
there
to us.
There really are.
The wealthy people showed off with nicer dyes, which means there's bright greens and reds and golds and all the rest. I don't think I have tartan blindness.
Okay.
But it does all kind of blur together. Like, I have this idea, for example, the cardboard backing, cardstock backing on a roll of Scotch tape.
Yeah.
You can picture that green tartan. Like, I kind of think of that as...
There's a lot of red in that.
Generic Scotland tartan. Yeah, sometimes they're green, sometimes they're red. They are, in fact, what 3M claims is that is based on the tartan of the Wallace clan, which would go back to...
And they're big, the Wallaces.
That would go back to William Wallace of the 13th century war with the English that you probably know from history and I probably know from Braveheart.
I also know it from Braveheart.
Freedom!
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Do you know why Scotch tape is called Scotch tape, by the way?
Oh, it never occurred to me. Why?
Do you have a guess?
Let's see. They're so sticky and hard to get rid of. No, they over time they lose their stickiness and then they kind of curl up at the edges and get yellow.
That's actually true of all people.
Oh, right. Let's see. It's because they're so thrifty that they would... Is it really?
That is it.
No kidding.
Because you know the stereotype of the Scots, especially in the UK, right?
Yeah, right.
I read a book of humor theory that says many cultures have these two different outsiders, one of which they get to spit on because they're dumb yokels, and the other one they get to spit on because they're too crafty. You know, like a lot of anti-Semitic tropes in our culture, for example, are aimed at the crafty group.
Right, although the great thing about anti-Semitism is it gets both.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, well, they're crafty, but they're also really
I have this other pamphlet. yes. But in England, that tends to be directed at the Irish. They're the dumb hayseeds.
Right.
And then the Scots are the ones that are a little too crafty, and that often means they're penny-pinching skinflints.
And why do the Welsh get slandered with being people that go back on contracts?
I guess there's no... Oh, yeah, that's true.
Right? Like, ugh, he Welshed on the deal.
I guess they had an inconvenient third country and they didn't have a nice stereotype.
I mean, the Welsh are also living in holes and also, I mean, not particularly crafty, but super...
They're just the pretty. Irish without the music. I mean,
yeah,
Tom Jones and... Shirley Bassey.
I think they kept the singing to themselves. If you came into a Welsh club, quietly. They stopped singing.
But yeah, so the idea is that Scotch tape would let you fix and save an item that would otherwise be lost, just like your thrifty Scottish forebears would have done.
It's amazing. You know,
so there's a racial slur in the name of the product.
The amazing thing about American racism is that it even included Presbyterians, like, white Protestants? The wrong kind.
Let me tell you some kind of unsavory things about them. And there is even jokes about, you know, the Scottish kid that runs home and tells his dad that he ran home behind the bus and saved Tuppence, and the dad hits him and says, "Sandy, why didn't you run home behind the streetcar and save Thruppence?" You know, like just stupid kind of jokes like that.
I think that's a great joke.
Yes, I maybe told it wrong. One thing I learned at the National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh is, first of all, that the National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh is too big to maintain anyone's interest for. we started at the basement in Scottish prehistory and made it all the way up to the Industrial Revolution before we lost steam 3 hours later.
Right.
Only to look at the map and find that there were many more floors to go, bringing us into the 21st century of Scotland. And then other wings about Scottish art and design and fashion and science and world anthropology.
Maybe a lot people go to Edinburgh just to spend their whole vacation in the different wings of the Museum of Scotland.
I could have seen a lot of kind of poorly thought out one-man shows at Fringe, but instead, I just moved into the National Museum of Scotland.
You were like, oh, the tartan of Gordon. Oh, the tartan of the gun.
But starting at the prehistory means like you see a lot of maps of Scotland. I had never really internalized the difference between highlands and lowlands. You know, mm-hmm. I guess I thought, yeah, there's probably a mountain range running down Scotland the way, you know, the way the Appalachians or the Rockies do. And in fact, no, like if you look at a terrain map of Scotland, as I spent an hour doing at this place, because I couldn't find the exit, is that like pretty much everything north of this kind of weirdly drawn line is just this endless rugged wilderness of
no trees and just wind swept.
Some of it's forested, but it's not like a single mountain range running the length of Scotland. It's like everything above this certain latitude, and then there's this fertile plain below it where the cities are. And that is, you know, the difference became a cultural one, but it's super visible on a map. And it's because 400 million years ago, like Baltica, the paleo continent with Scandinavia on it, smashed into Laurentia, the paleo continent with Greenland and North America, and it hit at Scotland and just started crumpling it. And that's why, you know, north of a certain part of Scotland, you know, the mountains, all the deposits are the same as they are in North America. Like it matches Newfoundland because that's what it used to be. And, you know, the crumpling stopped at the farmland of the plains, well, what would become farmland. And it was basically like two countries for, you know, it doesn't make sense to consider Scotland as one country, except that they were getting Vikinged enough that they kind of teamed up. Because it's two very different regions.
And so from Hadrian's Wall to the end of the or to the beginning of the Crumple is one entire universe, and then pretty north much of the Crumple, it's a whole other thing.
It's complicated a little bit because there are some southern uplands south in the borders, kind of south of the fertile plain of the lowlands.
Where's Balmoral? It's kind of it's up a little bit, but
Balmoral is kind of an important story of tartans taking over that we'll get to. Yeah, Balmoral's kind of like due west of Aberdeen. It is absolutely in the highlands.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I went there and it felt very mountainous around it. Or if not mountainous, you know, we were up high and it was.
And if you look at a list of those mountains, there's just endless lists of what they call the ranges of mountains and hills up there. It's just trackless wilderness.
Yeah, from a Washington perspective, it's like it would all fit into one park, but.
You know, that's true.
Or lake.
And the things they call mountains, you know, are, you know, to us, they're quote marks mountains.
Right. You'd ride over them on a horse without any trouble.
But Ben Nevis, the highest peak in the British Isles, is there, you know. And if you've
been, is that, 300 meters?
It's 300 feet. It's about the size of like a large Des Moines skyscraper. Uh-huh. No, that's not true. But the, you know, the cultural differences that were a result of that, of the kind of those being two very distinct regions, lasted for centuries. You know, in the north, up in the highlands, those were Gaelic, those were the Gaels, those were Celtic people.
That right, okay.
You know, look at a map, you'll realize how close Scotland gets to Ireland there.
Yeah.
Those were people that came over from Ireland, whereas south of there in the lowlands, those were Pictish people.
So did they come from Ireland, or was it just part of the Gaelic? As the Gaels got pushed out of Europe by the Germans, did they just hit Scotland on the way to Ireland?
I don't think that order is. I mean, they are related, obviously, to the other Celtic peoples, the Gauls and so forth. But I don't I think they might have.
I mean, how would you even get to Ireland without going through, I guess, on a boat?
I've been to Ireland without going to Scotland. It's super easy. And then I'm like, hey, did you know my family's Irish? I'm sure if I'm wrong about that, I'll get corrected. But, yeah, it's essentially the same culture as Irish Gaelic culture originally before it branched off. And then later, the Pictish people in the south, the ones that Julius Caesar said were,
the blue
inked ones. With the blue woad or whatever. Later, a lot of Anglo-Saxons mixed in and even Normanized. After the conquest, Normanized Scots lived in the lowlands. For example, Robert Bruce, his name Bruce is a French name. It's B-R-U-I-X or B-R-I-X or something. Blue. Yeah, it's Robert Bruce. So, even in Scotland, even in the lowlands, the aristocrats were the newcomers. But that means a big, of course, rural versus urban divide. All the cities were in the lowlands. There's a religious divide. There's less Roman influence. The further north you got, the language is different.
Where did the Picts come from? This seems like something I should know. They're just one of those like prehistoric stone carving people that like no one knows who they were or where they came from.
I think that's more or less it. We know that I think in medieval times they were considered to be, they were considered to be immigrants as well. Stories of them coming from Eastern Europe or,
from,
the mysterious isles of the sea.
Stonehenge.
But yeah, it really is one of those. As long as anybody was there writing stuff down, there were blue guys in the hills.
Yeah.
Or not the hills in this case, in the valleys. There was a religious difference because in the highlands, there was the old style, the Catholicism later turned old style Episcopalian stuck around for longer, whereas Reformed Presbyterianism
is from the lower.
That's the new hotness.
And they were connected to the Dutch. The Lowland Presbyterians had a Dutch friendship.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think so.
That makes sense.
Yeah, they were. They had some commonalities.
The reforms were going on in both places at once.
So in the north, there was an episcopal return to tradition safe from the purges. But
well, it had never occurred to me until now that I think Episcopalian means having bishops. That's what episcopo means, and then presbyter means priest. So it's like who runs your church? Do you still have bishops like those? It's kind of these anti-papists like those suspect Romans,
right?
Or are you run by a series of ministers? That's the ethos of Presbyterianism. No apostolic succession through bishops to trouble you. That's all by way of saying there's vast cultural differences between these two adjacent regions, and those ethnic differences, Gael versus Pict, and or Anglo-Saxon, Norman, whatever else, all the different kinds of Britons that eventually got mixed in. All those were preserved as kind of regionalisms, different tribes, different clans, maybe not too different than the way different indigenous tribes would have been operating in the Americas before contact, with their, interdealings with each other, but
you have to imagine that's sort of a universal trait of humans that kind of connect with one another within a day's walk or 4 days walk, but then people beyond that are sus.
You don't really explore that much,
Maybe your warriors do or your hunters do, but they're out in the. I mean, I experienced that a lot. Did I ever mention that I walked across Europe?
You missed Scotland. I was hoping we would avoid it here, but
many times even in Germany, I would say, well, I'm headed up the road here, and I'll I'm going to be in Hof or whatever in 3 days. And the people in whatever part of Germany I was in would go, oh, you got to watch out for those people. I'm like, you're all German, it's like, oh, the people in that part of Germany.
Yeah, that's kind of related to the people across the river.
Yeah.
They're the dumb ones or they're the ones that cheated us.
Yeah, it's 1 hour's drive away,
Yeah, you wouldn't know about the stereotypes of the people who actually lived, 1,000 miles away or 500 miles away.
No connection to them at all.
You wouldn't have a grudge.
But all of this is played out in modern Ireland. The two worlds are.
Oh, I guess that's true.
Vastly different,
including the religious divide,
everything,
language divide. So tartan or you know, the twilled cotton cloth with the check pattern that we think of as tartan.
Wait, it's cotton?
I think so. No, sorry, it's wool. It's originally wool. You're right. It's a wool cloth. It dates back to the oldest example in the National Museum of Scotland. Actually goes back to the 3rd century. Like the,
no way.
Yeah, there's a Roman hoard of like 2,000 coins in some kind of earthenware jug, and there's a little scrap of fabric in there, which under examination appears to have a very simple example of what's called the border check, which, you know, if you picture the simplest plaid, it'll be that. It'll be an undyed background with horizontal halftone stripes and vertical halftone stripes that then get darker where they intersect.
Wow.
Of the same color.
3rd century.
And as you can imagine, this was a huge find.
And that must have been, I mean, that's the earliest example, but it's kind of evidence that it's older than that.
Exactly. Like that's just the fragment we have. And there's, you know, writings back to Roman times, you know, Virgil, for, you know, recording the different Gallic peoples, whether it's the Gauls in France or different Celtic peoples, they do wear things that Virgil describes as kind of striped or variegated. Like this was a quality of those people that they would, that the Romans would know, like, you know, they didn't have, they couldn't say like, they're all in plaid, but they noticed that there were these kind of striking color change patterns that the Romans did not have by the custom. And so as a result, when we see Roman statuary of these kind of Celtic enemies today, they actually use different alloys, different bronze and silver in the sculpture to show that they're wearing their distinctive, you know, proto-Czech.
So it seems like just the way things are woven, warp and weft, that there that it would have occurred to somebody
that you could switch colors.
Switch colors, but it, that's not a commonplace thing in other
it wasn't cultures. It wasn't customary.
You would the opposite. You'd try and find matching yarn.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
And color becomes, you know, a single color becomes a status symbol or a way to recognize something about you.
Yeah. And I wonder if it was an austerity measure on the part of the Scots, if this was, if it's just another example of Scots tape where they were like, well, we got all these mismatched colors, put them together. I don't know why my, I've got a Liverpool accent.
I'm from Scotland and therefore I talk like this. The designs got more complex over time. In the 1980s, for example, in a peat bog near Loch Ness, a fragment was unearthed called the Glen Affric tartan, which I think is now in some kind of private collection, but the V&A in Dundee sometimes exhibits it. It was faded, but you could tell that it was a much more complex check, and there's 4 different dyes in the thread. So the plaids that they're using, to use their Gaelic word, would have been you know, getting more and more complicated into the Middle Ages. The kilt has 16th century origins.
Oh, so not that old, really.
Well, in fact, the kilt as we know it is much newer than that, because that kilt is now called the Great Kilt. That's kind of the retronym for it. It had the, you know, it was a robe that left the legs open, which obviously for a warrior people, you know, wading through boggy moors or riding on horseback or wanting to be unencumbered in battle, as you discovered, playing Frisbee, there's a lot of advantages to not wearing pants.
Even in modern life, but I don't do it around town.
And so, and some disadvantages, exactly. You know, if you're riding a bike, for example. And it would have, but this one had a hooded cloak. Like it was a full body kind of robe that wrapped up around your upper body, and you could even put over your head. The modern kilt, just the sewn garment around the midsection, only goes back to about 1800. And I think what I did not know about tartans until spending last week in Scotland is I had, there have always been regional variations in, you know, the people around here tended to have cloth that looked more like this. There was more green up there, you know, this stripe pattern here. So there, you know, it's not like they were uniform, but the idea that every Scottish family had a distinctive clan tartan, is a poppycock. It's modern romanticism and revisionism. We have lots of portraits of Scottish lairds of various eras just wearing multiple plaids.
Yeah.
Because there was no medieval idea that this is my clan and this is its tartan.
You know, in the Americas, we have several examples of indigenous people here using weaving or beading as a language, or as a form of recording history or stories, or doing
the Aborigines do it too.
So I've heard that story too, that the plaids were, that all the different weaving was some kind of language.
That it's recording things about, here's our historic, here's what we did at the Battle of Culloden. And
yeah, or like a crest, this stripe represents the McLeods and this stripe represents the McLeans. And, but that's not true.
Are you out of Scottish names?
That was it. McLeod, McLean.
those are your two?
And McLaren.
No, here's the story of where this modern misconception that leads to Outlander fans writing angry blog posts comes from. Just to recap some Scottish English history that I will probably get wrong, but I put in 3 hours at the National Museum of Scotland. I feel like you can leave me alone now. I'm more up to speed about this than I should be.
You know, all the people in the world that are concerned about all the tiny little things that we get wrong are missing the big picture, which is that we are always right.
Exactly. The end of the Tudor dynasty in England came about because Elizabeth I, for reasons of her own that historians still argue about, did not ever marry or have children.
Oh, yeah. I mean, certain historians are arguing about it. Most historians don't give one good goddamn about it.
Oh, I see. They don't care.
Not really.
I didn't want to imply that all historians have a different theory.
No. It's just that is a thing that if you want to theorize about, you can.
But it's a pretty big deal because it ended this.
But it's often true, right? That a king or queen will die and leave no progeny.
Right. But in this case, you know, the Tudors were, you know, Elizabeth was this iconic symbol of Britannia and people were writing epic poems about her. What a remarkable new age we lived in. And then it just ended immediately.
Reap.
With no more Tudors. It had kind of been understood as she aged that the Stuart family that had been kings of Scotland were the obvious heirs. And this is what happens. James VI of Scotland takes on the English throne as well. So I guess you could argue that England becomes part of Scotland and not the other way around.
The Scots are the colonizers.
The Scots are the real Britain.
It's the French and the Scots who are colonizers. The English have always been more or less innocent. They're just caught in the middle.
They're just along for the ride. I guess we don't have a queen anymore. Can we have yours?
And also the Vikings, right? Poor English. Poor Anglo-Saxons.
So James VI either gets an upgrade or a downgrade and becomes James I simultaneously of England. He's a Schrodinger's Scot. He's both the first and the sixth. I guess he's James the 3.5.
Does it average out?
Yeah, I think that's how it works. Oh. Over time, he becomes James the 3.5. But what happens later, I mean, we can skip Cromwell and all this, but the problem with the Stuarts later that becomes relevant here, I'm bored already, is that his grandson, James II, converts to Catholicism.
Yeah.
And at first he has the support of a largely Protestant Europe, but that tends to wane. He gets, I think, quite a bit weirder about it. Is he the one that gets really into demon hunting maybe?
That's passed down through my family. We still hunt demons.
Like, but inner demons?
Yeah, sadly. The ones that no medication can touch.
And what you eventually get as a result is a glorious revolution. James II does not get to install any of his Catholic heirs on the throne. But luckily, his daughter Mary has married a Dutch Protestant king, prince.
There we go.
And that's why William of Orange, that's why Mary II, or the future Mary II, returns gloriously to England with her husband William of Orange, the future William III, and they become co-monarchs. Now, as you can imagine, if you're one of James II's Catholic offspring, this chafes a little because you just got passed over for a girl.
Although,
just because she doesn't light candles at mass.
A kilt is a great way to avoid chafing.
Exactly. Maybe they're not chafed at all. They don't even have that word. They're like, I feel a little, what would it be like if your legs rubbed together more?
But doesn't the word chafe sound like a Pictish word, like a sort of Scottish?
I assumed it was the onomatopoeia of your thighs running together.
Oh, like chafe. Yeah, okay, I see that.
So this leads to a series of uprisings as James II's son, who would have been James III of England, James VIII of Scotland, tries to maneuver for the throne. And eventually his son, Charles Edward Stuart, I think, Bonnie Prince Charlie, is able to like marshal a series of uprisings during the 18th century, trying to restore to him his throne that had been taken away by religious hatred.
How strange that a rich guy could convince a lot of just regular folks to fight for his wealth and power.
Here's where tartans come into it. Okay. The Jacobite uprisings end in 1745 with the passage of the Dress Act, which is often said to ban the wearing. In modern times, it's been said that the intent was to ban the wearing of the tartan. And that appears to not be true. Tartans are mentioned in the language of the act, but it only says that men and boys can't wear a robe with a tartan. It's really more about banning the kilt and other regalia. They call it Highland garb.
Oh, so it's like not letting people wear hoodies in high school.
That's more or less it, yeah. I mean, there's probably some more colonialist example of...
But it's got some... The implication is that it's a war, or it's like a... They're trying to curb violence and insurrection.
Yeah, but they're also trying to they're trying to end the culture. It's often said that the pipes and the Gaelic language are banned as well, and that's not actually true. But it is true that you can't wear Highland garb and you can't carry a weapon. I guess it is kind of analogous to gang colors in a high school. And
well, you know, one thing the pipes do is call.
That's maybe the only thing they do.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Right.
I feel like when I was in Edinburgh, they actually called me to find a different busker. Like to maybe like try a different side street.
Wait, where this there is were not no something pipers. That I experienced. Are there bagpipers on the street busking
in August during the arts festival? I mean, if you're from Edinburgh, I think you kind of hate August and you get out of town if
sure,
you can,
sure,
because it is just chock-a-block with tourists, and what they want to hear is.
That reminds me of my childhood, because I swear to you, we did all of that before we learned that it was all just a fake. But no, I only ever went to Edinburgh in the winter, so all I remember is just rain and people being drunk and sad.
Well, today it would be that, but also still people lined up at Harry Potter adjacent tourist attractions.
I see.
So today's the day we're going to find out that not just your Scottish heritage, but in a way, all Scottish heritage is a little bit fake.
Okay.
At the same time,
let's take them down. You know, they're a smug people. Let's get them out.
They've had it coming to them for so long with their thrifty repairs of things. Let's take them down a peg. At the same time as Highland garb is legally on the outs, at the same time, you know, a lot of these different tribes and clans up in the Highlands have had their own military regiments. And after Union, after England and Scotland become one country, the British Crown decides that they want to leverage some of these doughty warrior people of the North. And so they create their own kind of little military, you know, kind of Minutemen-like commando groups.
This is like turning the Sikhs into... like an elite force.
It's exactly like turning, it's the same military thinking probably. The same manual probably did it to the Sikhs. Earlier did it to the Scots. And if you were one of these Highland regiments, you were allowed to still wear the kilt. You were allowed to carry a weapon. And so by the time that the Dress Act is actually repealed in 1782, the image of Scotland that had been created by the Jacobite uprisings and by just racism in general is starting to change. You know, the treasonous savages that your grandpa would have or your dad would have invaded against have kind of become a noble warrior people.
Sure, that's how you domesticate a unruly mob.
You turn them into noble savages of the Glen.
Yeah, you say, oh, you can wear these hoodies, but only if you adopt Thrasher emblem, Thrasher skateboard emblem.
If you can get it at Hot Topic, it's okay. In this case, I think the prime mover of this kind of change is the novels of Sir Walter Scott, Edinburgh native Sir Walter Scott, whose tomb I kept having to walk by. If you might be aware, have you ever read
Scott? Isn't it interesting because we think of him as a chronicler
of history. And in fact, he's not. He's writing decades after the actual Jacobite uprisings and making them seem really romantic and cool.
Right.
You know, in the same way that 1920 Southerners could kind of get all lost cause-y about the Civil War, in a way that would not have flown when anyone remembered it.
Yeah, you know? Or anybody from Generation X on social media talking about how amazing it was in 1977 to have your parents neglect you and be drunk all the time.
You could just go to the arcade, man.
You know what? Neither of my parents even remembered me.
So novels like, I think I've probably read Ivanhoe, but it might have been Classics Comics Ivanhoe. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah,
I definitely read as part of like a syllabus in some of my classes, like Bits and Bobs, but never sat down with Ivanhoe.
Have I ever read, have I seen the Liam Neeson Rob Roy? I can't even swear that I did.
I don't think I did.
Also, he's Irish, so that's a problem. But Walter Scott, really, these novels are incredibly successful. His name is Scott, which has to help.
That's nice.
And, you know, everybody starts thinking of these, you know, it's like the January 6th thing or the Lost Cause thing, where these people who literally tried to overthrow the government are now kind of fondly thought of as these, you know, romantic figures of yesteryear, because by now they are.
But Scott wrote like domestic, like novels.
They're like romances.
Yeah,
they're
romances.
I mean, they're
right?
All romances, but a lot of them do have big adventure elements. A lot of them, I mean, Ivanhoe is kind of a medieval knights and damsels thing, but a lot of, like Rob Roy and Waverly and a lot of those novels are specifically set during the Jacobite uprisings, right. And then they get mistaken as history. Jacobite, by the way, being the demonym for like Jamesian.
Oh.
Like Jacob and James are both ways to say the biblical name James. In different ways. So the Jacobean era, the Jacobite uprisings, it's just the adjective of King James.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app, with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Anywho, in 1822, the Hanovers are now on the throne. George IV is going to become the first German king, the first Hanover king of England and Scotland, of Great Britain, to visit his Scottish subjects. The other three Georges couldn't be bothered,
uh-huh,
I guess.
Uh-huh. I mean, it's a long trip.
George III was talking to trees.
It's pretty rainy up there. And then, of course, in the summer, it's just full of midges.
Imagine a time when the royal family does not go to Scotland.
It's the opposite of now.
28 weekends a year.
Yeah.
So George IV is going to visit Scotland. And who is placed in charge of all the state spectacle that's going to happen? None other than Sir Walter Scott.
Of course. Because he was a bestseller.
He's a big local celeb. He's King Neptune of this thing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as Scotland's premier chronicler of this new romantic ideal of the Highland clans, he really pulls out all the stops. And he decides every noble is going to greet King George in full kilt and Scottish regalia. And in fact, that the king, they're going to make a new Scottish outfit for George IV. You know, this German guy who's never been to, well, of German origins, right, who's never been to Scotland. And all these Scottish lairds, most of them kind of moneyed lowlanders, are suddenly having to scramble and try and figure out what they're going to wear to this thing. And despite our common misconceptions, they did not have 500-year-old medieval tartans to fall back on. They needed something for their clan.
Right. And the late arrivers found that all the good tartans were sold out, and they had to get one with yellow and purple in it.
There was an outfit called Wilsons of Bannockburn that obliged all these 19th century lairds by producing tartans to order. Like, hey, we're the MacGregors. We don't really have, what should we wear to this thing? And, you know, so it was actually a fashion firm, weavers, saying, you know what would look good on you?
Yeah.
And just inventing literally from the whole cloth.
You've got red hair and hazel eyes. Hair and hazel eyes.
And if you look at Wilsons of Bannockburn's catalog for much of the 19th century, they do have all these patterns that are literally named for Walter Scott novels. Like, they are not hiding the fact that...
The Waverly.
Yeah, exactly. Do you want the Waverly? Do you want the Rob Roy? You know, these are all, they're really saying we are creating the fictional Scotland you love and putting it on real life nobility. And this is the beginning of what we still see today when you're not surprised when you see King Charles or some other member of the royal family in a kilt.
Yeah, right.
You know, it seems
part of the unity of the UK.
As a kid, I would think it was weird when you would see Prince Andrew in a receiving line wearing a kilt, and then you just see it so often, it just kind of goes away, and you're like, yeah, these people are, they're the King of Scotland too, I guess.
You know, my daughter and I went to a powwow last year. At the with the Muckleshoot tribe, did I tell you this story? And we were watching the powwow unfold.
It's not. Is it the one out on the island?
They don't do that anymore. No, it's here. It's up by White River, mm-hmm. And it was not until I was about halfway through the powwow, because there were tribes from all over, and you know, there are these tribes that I kind of know, the Skycomish, the Puyallup, the Swinomish, so forth, and they'd all sent different representatives, the Lummi. But everybody was wearing feather headdresses, buckskin fringed dancing outfits, right? And they're all doing dancing, and they all have very common, there's a lot of songs that you can tell are common among all the different tribes. And it was only after a while that I was like, wait a minute, you know, the Northwest tribes didn't have any of this. You know, they were completely oriented to the sea. They had a longhouse culture. Their regalia was all sort of woven.
Buckskin fringe.
There were no feathered headdresses and, you know, colored like all the stuff.
Are they tanning otter leather?
That wouldn't have been, because you see sometimes, you know, at these canoe ceremonies or stuff out at the Morning Star, people of local tribes and local regalia. And
you know what it looks like.
Yeah, it's got, you know, the conical hats. Yep. And so I talked to somebody from the tribe and I was like, hey, I'm outside here. I'm outsider, obviously, but can you explain like why the Tlingits and the Haida are dancing in this thing with like purple feathers? And the answer was,
because of you, white man.
well, no, that like just generally all of the tribes have kind of settled on the idea that like, well, this is sort of what Indian is.
Yeah.
And so when we all get together, we're not performing for any
Oh, I see. It's not a show for you.
No, this is just us coming together for our party.
Pan-Indianness.
Yeah. Like I was one of a very small group of people, my daughter and I, that were just there like in the bleachers, like, hey, nice to see everybody. Like we're checking it out. No, this was completely a sort of an internal celebration, but that they'd all sort of come around to this, like, well, the Plains Indians and all of that is sort of the language that...
Which is funny because it's like, it's kind of the fault of the Western, you know, that became America's idea of nativeness.
Yeah, well, it's sort of this Sir Walter Scott thing where it's like, well, eventually the movies interpreted us to ourselves, and rather than get together with people from the, you know, from Montana... And do a thing where it's like, well, here's, now you come dance at our potlatch or whatever. They were just like, you know what, we'll just like have the same drums. And
it's exactly what happened here. Like there's for the first time this pan-Scottish identity, which spans the Highlands and the Lowlands, and everybody agrees what it is. And it's kind of this Walter Scott mythologized, you know, Jacobite regalia.
Was the bagpipe also kind of a regional instrument?
I think that might be true. I think bagpipe is mostly Highlands as well. And it, in the same way that Indianness became Plains culture,
right,
Scottishness became Highland culture. So the thing that really cements this happens shortly thereafter. In the 1830s, these two English brothers turn up named the Sobieski Stuarts.
That doesn't even sound like an English name.
No.
Sobieski.
Sobieski, you know, somebody's got a Hungarian ancestor, but also the Stuart seems to be appended so that they can claim that they are cousins of the deposed royal house of Scotland. And in fact, in their case specifically, they are the secret grandsons of none other than Bonnie Prince Charlie.
Oh my goodness.
Himself.
That's quite a claim.
And they go around Scotland telling everyone, I'm just imagining these kind of Harold Hill style con artists, telling everyone that they have a secret 15th century manuscript called the Vestiarium Scotium, you know, Scottish dress.
They weren't talking about there being like gem mines in Wyoming that they're trying to sell you.
It's kind of the equivalent. It's the fashion equivalent of some diamond scam because they produce this beautiful kind of coffee table book of all these lowland tartans. And they say that, yeah, this is the history. These are the tartans of all the clans. Even you lowlanders who didn't know you had one, we have here the secret history passed down from our forebears. And people would say, can you show us the manuscript? You know, customers or academics, can you show us that manuscript? And they'd be like, sure. We just have to do it in a few weeks because,
yeah.
Or yeah, I sent you, didn't I send you those facsimiles? Did you not get those facsimiles?
The true code is applied at the factory.
Every time they're asked to actually show the Vestiarium Scotium, they cannot do it. But they produce this beautiful, what we now know to be a forgery, and what they should have known at the time to be a forgery, establishing what the tartans would have been.
And do they do a survey of all the surnames of Scotland? Or, I mean, how do they put this together?
It's basically what it is, I think. It's the equivalent of trying to sell somebody those personalized bicycle plates where it's like, is your name Betsy? You should buy this one. This pencil says Betsy. Don't you want 12 of these?
See, you're lucky because your name is Ken. My name's John. There's always a license plate for us.
No, you're lucky.
But my daughter's name is just one vowel away from a common name, and she has in her whole life never found a license plate that
happened. There's a standardized list somewhere. There's some Vestiarium Scotium of these license plates. And when I was a kid, I think my name was always there, and one or both of my siblings, their names were not there.
Oh.
And it really did sting.
So did you just buy every Ken you saw, just like, hey, look, I've got another one, just cover your wall with them?
I feel like I never got any Ken stuff. But my parents did get us our names on pencils at one point.
That's very cool.
And my sister's, well, check this out. My sister's name is Gwyneth, but somehow it had gotten misspelled. I think this was maybe my grandparents had done it and they had filled out the form wrong. So it had two N's.
Scrivener's error. Yeah.
And as a result, I realized that it was closer to my name than hers. It had the two N's. All you had to do was cover up the GWI and it was mine. So I stole one of her pencils and falsified my own name.
Oh, you dog.
And she was furious.
I'm furious on her behalf.
She went to the piano and wrote a song called They Scratched Out My Name on My Pencil.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you still sing it?
I can.
Let's hear it.
We still do it at family gatherings.
Let's hear it.
They scratched out my name on my pencil. They scratched out my name on my pencil. How could they do such a terrible thing to me? Wow. It's kind of operatic.
Yeah.
How could they do such a terrible thing? And then it comes back around. Right. They scratched out my name on my pencil. So that was the only monogrammed thing that I think we ever got. And it was a stolen valor.
And at no point did anyone in the family go, Magnifico!
It's true. It's Bohemian Pencil Rhapsody.
It is.
That just occurred to me now. Anyway, so suddenly, it's not until like the early 19th century that all these clans, even the big ones, are like, oh, of course this is our tartan. And what's more, the Sobieski Stuarts say it always happened. This is what we wore when we saw the king. And in 1848, Victoria and Albert buy Balmoral, and the rest is history because they do it all in tartans, and this just becomes a fad, like everything Queen Victoria did.
But there was nothing about Victoria or her family that could trace itself to... I mean, are they...
It was vibes.
I guess it's just vibes.
They just wanted a summer house in the Glen.
Heard that.
Don't we all?
Yeah, it's nice up there.
Which among us would not want to be a laird of something?
I've seen The Crown. I know that that's where Princess Diana got to know Prince Philip.
It's where a stag symbolizing Diana's death often appears to you at critical plot moments.
That's right. Or what about that time when Elizabeth is out driving around in her Land Rover and she meets those two American tourists who are like, hey, you live around here? And she was like, I guess.
I'll pretend to be... Yeah, they have all kinds of wacky adventures up at Balmoral, I'll tell you that.
They do. They're a nutty family.
Because they drive their own Range Rovers and they don't heat the place in the summer. So today, this is the state of play. There are 8,000 registered tartans, the Scottish Tartan Authority.
8,000.
Everybody's Scottish or ancestrally Scottish descendants take all this very seriously. But the Scottish Scottish Tartan Authority believes that maybe 50 of these 8,000 patterns actually go back to even the Jacobite period of the 18th century history, much less the idea of medieval warriors in this green and gold or whatever.
Well, I'm also familiar with there being Irish tartans.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Like
that,
plaids?
That at some, or Irish plaids, that at some point all these shenanigans, this blarney, if you will, the Irish were like, hey.
We're Gaelic too. We're Celtic.
Where's our traditional tartans from?
Well, it's true that they would have had a history of checked patterns if the Romans and the archaeological evidence is right about this. But I imagine this is absolutely a thing targeting Irish Americans whose moms had pictures of Kennedy, who are now like, oh, I'm going to buy the O'Grady tartan. It looks really nice. I'm going to get this on a pillow.
Oh, my God. There is a website called welshtartan.com, welsh-tartan.com, and it has – but the Welsh tartans are
– Do you have a – did you Google Roderick Tartan?
Well, let's see. It all seems to be the same dumb dragon. Let's see what Roderick – No. Find any tartan.
Here's what whatever this website trying to trick you into buying stuff has a very elaborate tartan for you.
Really?
And I feel like you would like it. It's got so many colors.
Well, this
it's got a light blue and a medium blue and reds and yellows over a green and black check.
Welshtartan.com, when I type in Roderick, it says, you mean Prothero?
Yeah, that's
or right. Richards Pritchard?
Yeah, I meant Prothero.
Like, no, it's neither of those things. Where did you find one?
Oh, I just Googled Roderick Tartan. This would be Scottish people named Roderick, or more likely some merchant trying to target people named Roderick who think they might be Scottish.
Well, the thing is that when my family went to Scotland, they said Roderick is a first name in Scotland, not a last name. We don't have any.
It's true. This is the Roderick Dhu Tartan. What do you think D-H-U even means?
Probably means not Scottish.
This is a Sir Walter Scott character. See, it all comes together.
Really? Roderick Dhu?
Yeah, this is Bannockburn Weavers or whatever it's called, Wilsons of Bannockburn.
That is a pretty flashy plaid. I do kind of like it.
Roderick Dhu appears in Scott's poem Lady of the Lake. He's the chief of Clan Alpine. It's not clear. So yeah, it is a first name. So it's not clear if, is he historical?
It's $60 a square meter. No, wait, but the big one, the 13-ounce is $118. Whoa, the 16-ounce is $180 a square meter. How many square meters would you need to create, say, for instance, a tuxedo?
Yeah. Are you going to get a tartan tuxedo?
I mean, that'd be pretty rad if I was like, well, it's named after a Sir Walter Ruff.
The cummerbund character should be just black and everything else should be plaid.
And the lapels. Yeah. Black silk, cummerbund, tie, and lapels, and then the rest would be. That's hot tamales.
You should be the new Sobieski Stewart. John Sobieski Roderick heads to Wales to trick everyone into getting his new plaid tuxedos.
I'm here to tell you all about your history that I am inventing right now. And that concludes Tartans, entry 1279.DE2230, certificate number 26624 in the omnibus. Futureling social media died an inglorious death. It's happening right now.
As we record.
We're recording it even now as people are over on Mastodon and Threads trying desperately to cling to the idea that anybody cares about what they're thinking. And here's to them, I toast my cold coffee to our vainglorious friends. Are you on any of those? Are you over on Mastodon being smart and funny? Or
I'm on Blue Sky.
Blue Sky.
I like it. I don't really post.
Yeah. Threads is fine, but then every once in a while I log in and it's just somebody yelling at clouds. Just
Threads
like,
seems very political.
Yeah, not that into it, frankly. But I mean, but there are nice people there. When I post something dumb, there are plenty of people that are like, ha, 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 that's dumb. And I go, I know, these are good times, but they're not. You can find us, though, at Omnibus Project. You can also, if you Google at Omnibus Project, you'll maybe find Omnibus Out of Context, which always gives me a little laugh. You can find at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick wherever ats are sold. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and please do. Every once in a while, if you compliment me heartily enough, Ken will remember that I'm also on the show, and he'll send me your compliments.
You got one the other day.
I did. It was very nice.
If you're going to compliment John, could you put complimenting John in all caps in the subject line?
Yeah. Well, because the one that you sent me was nice. It complimented you for 2.5 paragraphs, and then it was like, also John. And you were like, see, I send you things.
See? That's the first time they've ever pivoted to you. I was. It was like a twist ending.
Yeah.
I was like, yep, I'm great. What's this?
You can hang out with other futurelings if you go to Facebook or Reddit or other places and say, hello, fellow futurelings. And they will say, what's your favorite mail truck? And then you'll have to, or show us your personalized license plate. You can mail us things to P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155. And I see you are opening boxes. Yeah, what have you found?
A couple people have sent us books. And this one is just to you, John, speaking of compliments.
There are two books in that box. Who are you kidding?
Oh, no. This one is all to you. Oh. Adam is a cartoonist who is a big fan of all your work. Mostly your podcasting. You and Merlin have kept me company over many long days.
Oh, that's nice.
Apparently he doesn't like this show, but that's okay.
He likes it enough to know that this is where he can send me mail about other shows.
But what? He publishes a strip called, what, Blind Alley? And here's a graphic novel called The Gulf. Oh, he's very good. He thinks this might be appropriate for a preteen, although there is sex and weed in The Gulf. Don't you love it when there's sex and weed in the Gulf?
Look, man, if you're not ready to read about sex and weed, then just go back into the womb.
The Gulf is where sex and weed should be.
Wait a minute, you're talking about the Persian Gulf?
I didn't read it.
Or Gulf between adults and children?
It could be the Gulf between childhood and adulthood. I don't know.
Well, this Gulf seems like it has lighthouses and trees, so not the Persian Gulf. Oh, this is good. Oh, I like this.
Isn't that nice?
And she'll like this, too.
Thank you, Adam. And then Ed sent us a copy of his book, The Walking Otters, an illustrated novel.
Hmm. Did they walk across Europe?
I'm looking for the illustrations. Ooh, there are illustrations. He has signed each of them. He's working his way through Omnibus and telling all his friends. I wonder what he's telling them. Just want you to know.
I'm listening to this really weird podcast.
It's not good by any measure, but...
Better than most.
Oh, but I think your copy is a little better than mine, because my copy, I believe, does not have this.
What?
Your copy has an inscription and a $20 bill.
Why did I get 20 bucks? Well, he recognizes that I'm not a millionaire.
But maybe you're not going to like this. Dear John, can't tell you how much I enjoy your role on Omnibus. Such a foil.
My role.
Such a foil. Why does my sidekick get 20 bucks and I get nothing?
I like to be here to keep Ken in check. Thank you. No, but he doesn't stipulate what I spend the money on. He's not like, here's for gas.
I don't know. I did not read it. It seemed to be not my business. All I know is
personal.
I keep pouring through mine and shaking it to see where the $20 bill is hidden, and it appears to not be in this copy of The Walking Otters. It's like the golden ticket. You got one of the few.
Yeah. Yeah, let's see here.
Thank you so much for sending us your work, Ed. Oh, I have some postcards too that I almost forgot about. Let's
Ed
see.
Also follows my policy of short, punchy paragraphs. He paragraphs at about the same frequency as mine. Yeah.
He also, I think there's Comic Sans here. Sans, we decided.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's not. It's an adjacent handwritten typeface, though. Oh, wait, is this Comic Sans?
Show it to me. I'm now the...
Go to page 346.
World expert on it. 346.
That is not, right?
Toward the end of the book here.
Yeah, I skipped ahead because I want to know what's going to happen to those otters. Like, are they going to keep walking?
Wait, I'm too far.
Or do they ever get to their destination?
346.
It's not.
Oh, no, it's not. But it's...
It's adjacent. It's,
yeah, pretty bad.
Billy sent us a postcard from Svalbard. He was apparently... the islands, what, north of Norway or whatever, wherever small Svalbard is.
Mm-hmm.
It was the departure point for Roald Amundsen's airship
mm-hmm.
and is the home of the Soviet mining town of Barentsburg, best known as the collection, as the location of the so-called Doomsday Seed Vault, which we have never done.
We've never done the Doomsday Seed Vault. That does seem like a thing that we would
extremely do. Omnibus, possibly too omnibus.
It's kind of in the, it's sort of a Svalbard is up. It's high, right? It's up by Greenland, but it's not. It's not near Soviet land. It's.
I was going to say Norway, but it's up there. It's pretty close to the North Pole. I think Lauren, if I'm reading this right, just found a bunch of old postcards and sent us this one of the town of Lee Vining, California. Don't you love old postcards like this where it's just like the most unremarkable main street you have ever seen, yeah. like borderline ugly. Yep, they sure do have a general store there, yeah. and it looks like a motel down the way.
Motel and
good
and
job.
There's kind of some like dusty mountains in the far background, and then like half of it is just sky.
Random car. the sky is a color that doesn't exist in nature.
Yeah.
Wish you were here.
Yeah, gas station. Wish you were here at the gas station with us. And then last but not least, let me encourage you as Omnibus listeners, if you enjoy my work... As Ken Jennings's loyal valet and foil, consider supporting the show at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Maybe more than any Patreon you've ever seen, this Patreon gives you value for the dollar.
Just off the charts.
Like the sheer amount of content and cool stuff, way cooler than the show itself. Is available to you, as well as the show itself, 2 days early and without ads.
Pretty good.
And, you know, we're accepting more and more ads all the time.
And we request that they be extremely annoying.
Very annoying, and then I read them in a very weird late-night voice, yeah. where I'm like, you know what you need.
If you don't want whatever that upsetting frozen sperm ad is anymore, it will cost you just $5 a month, a dollar a week to get rid of it.
Freeze your sperm.
Which of your other problems in your life could you get rid of for a dollar a week? Almost none, right?
A dollar a week, yeah, I guess, if that's how, if you're a cheapskate, make it $2.50 a week.
I'm just saying, like, at any price, like... Like, you could get rid of John talking about sperm for a dollar a week. Wouldn't you do 15 cents a day? Wouldn't you do it?
If you want to give me $20 a month, I will send you me talking about sperm directly to your inbox. Contact me at theomnibusproject@gmail.com.
There's a restaurant we really like that I will leave vague that is running a Patreon for their cookbook, and they are really undervaluing their prizes.
Oh, like, yeah.
Like, if you give it's them, gone. Like... $50 or something, they will like come to your house and cook you a meal.
Yeah, that's the Amanda Palmer problem, where she was like, at the $50 level, I'll take apart an entire typewriter and put your name, you know, and write you a book out of typewriter keys.
There's probably bigger Amanda Palmer problems than that, but you're right. Yeah. That is one of them. But. Even compared to them, I think we provide more value, even though we won't come to your house and make noodles.
For sure. I'm not going to take apart a typewriter for you, but I might do it for me.
Sure. And we probably have a level at which you would take apart a typewriter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Every man has his price.
Maybe you should put a new level in, a new monthly donation at that level. If anybody donates there, after 1 year, I will take apart a typewriter.
What about slipping a 20 into a self-published book? Does that get you to do anything?
We talked about Edward O'Malley and
he got an endorsement, yeah.
Yeah, and he, you know, it's somewhat of a cryptic explanation for the $20. He's just saying that I mentioned $20 once.
If I had mentioned $50.
You should have. You're doing it now.
Oh, well.
But nobody listens this far into the episode. It's just like four people that forgot to turn up. Four people that are asleep. And they're like, huh, what?
Is Ken's foil still talking? Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.